You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll introduce you to some of the many, many, many microbes and other organisms living inside your home.
First, we're taking a look back at some of the biggest news stories from around the state this year. This fall's election for governor took up a lot of headlines, but there was plenty more happening in 2018.
Heavy flooding caused damage in many areas of the state. The Foxconn Technology Plant broke ground in southeastern Wisconsin, and the UW system underwent a major reorganization. Plus, Wisconsin sports this year weren't quite what we've come to expect.
Robert Mintzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Darrell.
Thank you so much for taking the time with us, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Look, it's been a year.
Yes, it has. Well, before the midterms this fall, there were other elections in Wisconsin that people around the country were watching really, really closely. Before we get to those, though, why has Wisconsin become a place that people look to read the political tea leaves?
Right. So I was thinking about this as I was thinking about the stories of the year. And, you know, we sort of know how things turned out. But what I was thinking was the experience of 2018 really was this, like, a huge chunk of the year was spent trying to figure, wait, is this a good sign for Democrats? Is this, is this going to be something that benefits Walker or whatever? To answer your question, because Wisconsin in 2016 voted very narrowly for Donald Trump for president, I think that it was, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, this sort of upper Midwest are of intense interest to people who care about politics on the national level because they want to see whether the Republican Party's fortunes here maybe are changing, if there's a political backlash or just any sort of change. And as it turned out, there was one. We can talk about it.
Well, Rob, you were talking about some reading the tea leaves. You know, some of the early tests came in a special state Senate election in northwestern Wisconsin, had a Supreme Court race earlier this year. Wisconsin has turned into a battleground state now. When did that happen?
Yeah, Wisconsin is a battleground all the way, and it's in an interesting way, in a way that's totally flipped, where it had been sort of conventional wisdom forever that that Republicans do better in midterm years and in sort of special elections and nonpartisan elections where maybe young people don't show up to vote as much. It's more like habitual voters, older voters, and so that the thinking had been that benefits Republicans. But this year, in that Senate special election way back in January, in the state Supreme Court election in April, and then it certainly in the midterm elections in November, that was all turned on its head. It's a clear sign of the enthusiasm level among Democrats.
You know, in the spring, going back and looking at elections in Wisconsin over the course of the year, we had a legal fight over special elections for two open seats in the state legislature. And those were elections that Governor Walker didn't want to hold. Can you remind the listeners how all of that played out?
So in January, a Democrat in St. Croix County in western Wisconsin won a special election for a state Senate seat that was a giant upset. That was Patty Schachtner. And that became the first of the sort of, indications of the blue wave that may be coming or whatever. It was a worrying sign for Governor Scott Walker. Then that was followed relatively soon in April by the election to the state Supreme Court of Rebecca Dallet, who joined the court's liberal wing. And then Governor Walker said, maybe we don't want to have any more of these special elections. And that simplifies the case, but that was the order of things, and that was the case that a lot of people thought the special elections are not advantaging Republicans.
Robert Mintzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and we're talking about the year that was 2018 in Wisconsin. Let's move on to the Foxconn developments. Of course, the Foxconn technology plant broke ground this year in Mount Pleasant. The company made news throughout the year. One big move was a pretty huge partnership with UW-Madison. Can you go back and talk about the type of arrangement they made?
Sure. So they, as part of Foxconn's overall investment in Wisconsin, they announced in August a $100 million sort of matching donation to UW-Madison that would support engineering and research there, seen as a way of sort of bolstering, building a pipeline to the sort of jobs with the company that they will presumably be hiring in Wisconsin. On a bit of a smaller scale, still quite significant. In June, the company bought a building in downtown Green Bay with plans to open an innovation center there. So, that's part of the company's efforts to make a job pipeline for itself and also maybe to get some goodwill in other parts of the state outside of southeastern Wisconsin.
Foxconn also changed their plans, at least in part, for the type of products they were going to manufacture in Wisconsin. Talk about that process.
Right. So, in August, it was reported that that there was, in some new documents, the company was declining to specify exactly what type of screens would be made in Wisconsin. Basically, how big these digital touch screens, how big they're going to be producing at these facilities. And it's all very technical, and certainly, it requires somebody more studied in it than me. But the bottom line is that if they're making smaller screens, it's a less complex factory, and that probably means fewer jobs or less skilled jobs at the factory. And so that change in some of the contract language was seen as a red flag. And this is a question that is really not resolved here in December 2018. Certainly we still do not know exactly what the scale of the Foxconn project is going to be. It's going to be big no matter what, but there is a big difference between the upper end of, over 10,000 jobs, 13,000 jobs, and the lower end, which is more in the 3,000 to 5,000 job range, and that would make a big difference, those two numbers.
You bring up an interesting point, because when Foxconn was first announced, it was a huge deal. Governor Walker had made a huge deal about Foxconn. And then by the time we got to the campaign for governor and got to the home stretch, Foxconn really wasn't an issue that got talked about a lot. Why do you think that was?
I find it surprising, to a surprising degree, the extent to which Foxconn did sort of disappear from the governor's race as a campaign issue. My theory is that Wisconsinites are fairly divided on it, right? That's what the public opinion polling shows. And so it wasn't like an obvious political winner for either Walker or Evers to sort of drive their message on. And the other thing that makes it complicated as a political matter is opinion really is different in different regions of the state. And so if you're trying to have like a single statewide message, it's hard to do. I think it's certainly true that it did not help Walker as much as he hoped it would. But it also looks to me like it didn't hurt him nearly as much as, Democrats, I guess, at this time last year might have predicted or might have expected.
You were talking earlier about the partnership between Foxconn and the UW. Well, the UW system announced a huge change earlier this year. It decided to merge its two-year campuses with four-year colleges to create regional hubs. Why did this change come about?
So the essence of it, this is a sweeping restructuring plan. Finally took effect in September. It was, discussed and debated earlier in the year. The essence of it is, right, so this is an administrative restructuring. What the proponents of this plan to merge the two-year campuses with four-year campuses said it was four, is it allowed these campuses to continue. It avoided the hard choice of having to actually close some of these campuses. But then, you know, it's also a restructuring, which is another way of saying some people lost their jobs. The best theory about it, you know, enrollment in two-year colleges tends to be counter-cyclical, which is to say that if the economy is doing well and there are plenty of jobs to go around, the people who are maybe like a little on the edge, they're a little unsure whether they want to go to college or not, are more likely to decide not to go. And so as the economy has been pretty strong for, you know, some years now in Wisconsin, that has taken a toll on enrollments at these two-year, you know, these smaller campuses. And that's, you know, they've also been subject to the same budget pressures as the UW system as a whole, which has had reduced, you know, large budget cuts. And so, right, the financial picture at some of these campuses is pretty dire, and that's what led to this restructuring.
We're talking with Rob Mensah right now, living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some top state news stories from the last year.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What was the biggest story for you this year? Is there news that you think flew under the radar but had an impact where you live? Let us know what affected you this year, whether it's one of the stories we're talking about or something else. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us on Central Time. We're talking with Rob Mensah, a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking back at some of the biggest stories of 2018.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What felt like the biggest news of the year in your part of the state? Is there something that had an especially big impact where you live? Let us know what stuck out to you this year. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Rob, let's turn to a major ongoing issue in Wisconsin, farm closures, particularly smaller farms, and it showed no signs of stopping this year. What did we see exactly during the course of the year?
Yeah, the downturn for dairy farms is not a brand new story, but this year was an acute case of it. We are essentially in the fourth year in a row where that they faced really low milk prices and heavy pressure on international markets, and that really is unusual for the downturn to be that long. So just a couple of weeks ago, the state released data showing that Wisconsin lost 638 dairy farms in 2018. That is a decline of more than 7%, and it is the largest one-year drop since the state first started keeping these records, which is about 15 years ago.
We're in the fifth year of very low milk prices, which are tied to a high level of production. It seems like for a lot of farmers, it just isn't worth the effort anymore. Did you find that in your reporting and travels this year?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, and as you say, the pressure is the highest on smaller farms, but even medium-sized farms have trouble making ends meet at this level of milk prices. And an interesting thing is that the number of cows has remained pretty steady throughout this entire downturn and this year, too. So what's happening is it's harder to run these smaller, medium-sized farms, and more of the dairy farming in Wisconsin is run by these very large companies that manage thousands or tens of thousands of cows, because either they can, you know, they can make the numbers work, or the companies that large can afford to wait out this downturn in a way that a smaller farm, farm family, cannot.
Well, we saw this year that President Trump put tariffs on steel and aluminum imports into the U.S., and that sparked counter tariffs from a lot of the countries that buy agricultural products from Wisconsin. How did that factor into what's happening with many of the smaller farmers in Wisconsin?
So it certainly didn't help. Now there was a period. So there was a period during the summer when these we're sort of in this trade war, and these counter tariffs were affecting Wisconsin farms, and for farms that were already under strain, that was a very hard, you know, challenging time, and probably did push some in the direction of leaving their farm. By October, Trump signed a new trade deal, basically wiped away those tariffs, so that pressure was removed here by the end of the year. But it's not clear that what was gained in these last couple months has necessarily canceled out the losses from over the summer.
Let's take a call. Let's go to Lucas in Waukon, Iowa. Lucas, welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Did you have a question or a statement for Rob?
Yeah, something that made news in years past that didn't get a lot of attention this year, but I find it's still a big problem, is the cost of living continues to rise, but the rise in wages still hasn't caught up.
Rob, what do you think?
It's a fair point. I think that the there is some indication from what I have seen that that wages for manufacturing and other labor have begun to rise this year. But there's no question that those rises have been historically slow and have not kept up with people's costs in a lot of cases.
Let's move on to this past summer. The state saw some of its worst flooding ever this year, from Janesville and Madison to Chippewa Falls and Gays Mills. It led Governor Walker to declare a statewide state of emergency. Here he is talking in August after touring some of the flooded areas of the state.
Well, some areas have never been flooded before that we visited in the last week. Others have repeatedly. And so we'd like to make sure that part of it goes into not only recovery, but into mitigation, so we can hopefully prevent flooding like that from happening again.
Can you talk about the damage that we saw around the state of Wisconsin this year?
Right, yeah. So in August and into September, there was a period of a few weeks where it was just buffeted by torrential rains, so it was especially acute in western Dane County and sort of south central Wisconsin. By September, I think that there was damage estimates in Dane County were at more than $150 million. You mentioned the declaration of a disaster area, which would help direct some money to recovery efforts. But, I mean, yeah, we saw the photos, right? You see aerial photos of small towns with the roads totally washed out. And, I mean, it was really, really stark. And at least one person in Madison lost his life, a man who was whose car had stalled out. He got out of the car and was swept away by the currents, which were, it's a lot of water. It was really strong, and it was a lot of corresponding damage that came with those floods.
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, in the area of sports, the Brewers and Packers have had some interesting year for different reasons. Let's start with the good. The Brewers had a great year. They were one game from the World Series, and they really fired up the fan base. What were some of the highlights?
Yeah, the Brewers had a great run, especially the very end of the year when they won 8 games in a row to close out the season, and then extended that to 12 games in a row into the postseason, which they did lose out to the Dodgers. But that 12-game winning streak was enough for people to get those free hamburgers in Milwaukee that Webb's sponsored the free hamburgers. So everybody wins if you ask me.
On the other hand, on the flip side, the Green Bay Packers haven't fared as well this year. They're missing the playoffs, and they're also looking for a new coach. And there's been a lot of speculation and some criticism about the fact that Coach Mike McCarthy should have been allowed to finish the year instead of being fired with 3 games left. What do you think? This was a rough separation, or do you think that he and the Packers left on good terms?
He certainly left on good terms with the community of Green Bay and with Wisconsin as a whole. He took out those full-page ads in with my employer, God bless him, to say thank you to the fans and the community. And that was, you know, I think he was seen as a decent guy, as a class act, and really, really well loved for his long and very successful run with the Packers. At the same time, I mean, look, it was not a great season, and it's the first time since 2008 that the Packers didn't make the playoffs. It's not, I don't think anybody feels surprised that, like, you know, there's unrest among the fans and people kind of want to go a different way. We will see how that works out.
We have less than 2 minutes left, so I want to end it on this note. Some recent news to talk about, and that is former newscaster Republican State Senator Walter John Chilson died this week at 95. Can you talk about his legacy, especially in your part of the state?
Sure. Well, I mean, Walter John Chilson, as a Wausau guy, was an absolute institution. So yeah, he died on Christmas Day at 95. So he was a World War II veteran. He had started his career as a radio broadcaster out of Merrill, and then later as a TV news anchor out of Wausau. And then he served in the state Senate from 1966 until 1990, but he stayed involved in local issues and, serving on local boards basically right up until his death. Really a great guy, decent guy, and quite a life of public service that I think is an inspiration.
Rob, thanks as always for joining us here on Central Time. And again, Happy New Year and have a safe one.
Hey, thank you.
Rob Mincer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us to look back at some of the biggest Wisconsin news stories of 2018.
Some of you may be creeped out a little by our next conversation. Others, like me, may find it fascinating. Whatever the case, you're bound to learn an awful lot about who or what we share our homes and other spaces with.
Our guest biologist says there are more than 100,000 different life forms living alongside us, many of which you can't even see with the naked eye. In fact, every time you take a breath, you suck in a bunch of these things.
And when you sit down, there are thousands of species floating, jumping, and crawling all around you and on you.
Might make you want to jump in the shower, but those buggers live in the shower heads too and rain down on you.
But here's the thing. The vast majority of those species are actually good for us. So before you head off to sterilize your home, workspaces, cars, and what have you, you may want to hear our guest out. Rob Dunn is a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University, and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. His newest book is called Never Home Alone. From microbes to millipedes, camel crickets, and honeybees, the natural history of where we live. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me. What a great intro.
Well, I have to say, I've been so excited to talk with you because you just opened my eyes to a real universe, not just a world, but a whole universe of what lives around us. So give us some idea of how many different types of critters live in our homes.
Well, it depends a lot on your home, but thousands and thousands of species. And so I think that the breath example that you started with is a good one. So when you breathe in, every time you breathe in, you suck in about 1,000 species. And a tiny minority of those are potentially dangerous. Some of those are absolutely beneficial and even necessary. And most of those we know nothing about. And so every time you breathe, you suck in our ignorance.
Well, actually, that's an interesting point because I was fascinated to read that in your work and other people's work, it's actually very common to find brand new species in people's homes. Do we have a sense of how many of those species that are living alongside us are already known or still to be discovered?
Well, so the smaller the species, the more of them are not yet named. But even for things that are relatively big, like insects and their relatives, it's not uncommon to find totally new species indoors. And we even recently found a giant camel cricket, like the size, you can't see my thumb, but it's the size of my thumb, which is normal human thumb, in houses across North America. And it was, just as a case example, it was known to be present in North America, but not known to be in houses or common. And it turns out that there are tens of millions of these in homes. And everybody seemed to think that somebody else knew it was there. And so even when something's not a new species, we might not have noticed that that's right alongside us.
Well, and one of the things, Rob, that I think is very understandable in human nature is that biologists and other types of researchers, entomologists, microbiologists, they often think of going to do research in, say, you know, some far corner of an isolated rainforest because it's cool and it's fun. But it turns out that you literally wouldn't even have to leave your home to find something that could literally be a career's worth of research.
No, that's true. I mean, I started off working in rainforests and remote islands, and I mean, even had a chance to study deep sea vents at one point. And that's sort of how we're trained, to go far away, find nature in its most abstract and esoteric forms, and then come back and report on what we've found. But it's meant we've kind of left our daily life with nobody to study it. And so it's really actually, in some ways, it's easier to find totally new things indoors than it is in some more remote locales.
Well, and it also seems that while all of that research is important and useful, maybe it's even more important and useful to learn more about these creatures that we're coming into contact with every single day.
Yeah, I think in two ways. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, 23 out of 24 hours of the day we spend indoors in our cars, in our houses, in our offices. And so to the extent that we're exposed to biodiversity, it's these species inside. And so we should at least know who they are. You know, even if you don't like them, I think everybody can agree we should know who they are. But the other piece is that if we're going to be engaged in nature, if we're going to find nature interesting and have children who want to engage nature in the future, this is sort of a gateway biodiversity for getting engaged more generally and sort of going down those longer paths into deeper woods.
We're talking with biologist Rob Dunn about his new book called Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. And let's dig into some of those hot spots in our living spaces. You write about biofilm in our shower heads. What is that?
Oh, this is the one that even grosses me out a little bit. But yeah, so when you unscrew your shower head and you look into the pipe, you'll see some gunk, and it's always there. Every shower head we've looked in has it. And that gunk, scientists call biofilm. It's like a little apartment that bacteria group together to build out of their excrement, essentially. So it's sort of a fecal apartment, which, you know, it's not for everybody, but they like it. And so in those biofilm, there are always species living there, and for the most part, they're totally harmless, and you can't get rid of them if you wanted to, so you just have to be happy with their existence. But every so often, it seems like more and more, there are some species in those biofilms that seem problematic. And so one group of those species is a group called non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And for most people, these aren't problematic, but if you're immunocompromised, or if you have an unusual lung architecture, or a few other sort of pre-existing conditions, those bacteria can cause trouble. And in a tiny minority of healthy people, they seem to cause trouble too. And so we started to try to figure out what determines when those species are more common and when they're rare. And as we started to do that work, we realized that we didn't even have a basic map of where these species lived in the first place. And so we had to sort of go forth, like we might imagine explorers going forth 200 years ago, except we were going to do it showerhead to showerhead. And so we asked people around the world to send us samples of their showerheads. And when we did that, we found that, like we expected, everybody's showerhead had bacteria in it, but that some of those showerheads had more of this problematic kind of bacteria. And it turned out to be those showerheads from municipal water systems with more chlorine. Which is an interesting finding, because superficially it's at odds with what we might expect. We might expect that more chlorine, it kills more things, you're going to have less of the bad stuff. But what it looks like is happening is that in those systems where there's a lot of residual chlorine, the chlorine actually kills all the competition of the non-tuberculous mycobacteria, and they're kind of chlorine tolerant. And so they set up shop and become the dominant thing in your shower head. And so there's a whole kind of ecology spring down on you that doesn't really get studied very much.
I thought it was really fascinating that the critters living in something like a showerhead or a drain show really impressive adaptive qualities. What types of conditions are they having to adapt to in order to survive?
Yeah, so I mean, think about a showerhead. So the water in your showerhead doesn't have much in the way of food. There's a little bit of carbon in there, but not too much. I mean, if you tried to live on water, you wouldn't do well. And so first of all, they have to live in a low nutrient environment, but then they're also getting blasted with water. And so they have to be able to withstand that force. And so that's what that biofilm helps them do. And then sometimes that water is super hot. Sometimes it's really cold. And then in between, it's actually dry. And so they have to be adapted to all these really different conditions. And that's one of the things we found in general in modern houses that wouldn't have been true a couple hundred years ago, is we've created all these really unusual extreme conditions. And in doing so, favored the weird subset of bacteria that are able to live in those kinds of conditions.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Dennis in Two Rivers is up. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. What bothers me is I could go outside and I could die of hypothermia, but yet there's microbes that survive. Is that pretty typical, like viruses and bacteria survive in cold temperatures?
Thanks for that call, Dennis. Rob?
Yeah, that's great, Dennis. So it turns out that, yeah, bacteria can survive in much colder conditions than we can survive in, and much hotter. And so your freezer is actually full of bacteria that are doing just fine. And so is your hot water heater. So there's a kind of bacteria that's known mostly from places like Yellowstone hot springs and then hot water heaters in houses. And for those kinds of bacteria, for a long time, we didn't even know they existed. Because when we would try to grow bacteria, we would try to grow them more or less in conditions that we like, you know, conditions like Dennis likes in his house. And some species can't even tolerate our normal conditions. Not only do they like it hot or they like it cold, but they can't live in the conditions we think are good.
And thanks for that call, Dennis. So one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that we are coming into contact with all of these different species, these different microorganisms, sometimes not micro at all. Like you said, the camel cricket's the size of your thumb. But there might be an ick factor, but so many of them are actually necessary to us. What do we get from a lot of these species?
We get all kinds of things. And so we need to be exposed to a diversity of kinds of microbes for our immune systems to function well. We need to be exposed to the right microbes to have those microbes colonize our skin. And so, Judith, like your skin, like my skin, is covered with a layer of beneficial microbes that we need in order to live. Our guts are full of microbes that we need. And so these are all microbes we have to acquire after or during birth. And so they have to be around somewhere. So we need those. And we're seeing more and more that we're failing to be exposed to those. And so we see that C-section babies often don't get some of the gut and skin microbes that they need. That babies born in really, really, quote unquote, clean hospitals and born C-section often get skin and gut microbes that more closely resemble the microbes in the dust of the hospital than the microbes of a normal human. And at the same time, we're seeing that if you look at kids who are growing up in really, really clean apartments in cities, that they're developing all sorts of autoimmune and allergic problems associated with the absence of exposures that they would have historically gotten. And so we need this life around us. But I think one key piece is that historically, a lot of the life to which we were being exposed was soil microbes and leaf-associated microbes. And when we clean everything, what we get are just human-associated microbes, and they tend to be that 1% that's toughest and that we probably least want. Like if you look at the cleaning aisle in your grocery store, you'll see all this stuff that kills 99% of germs. Like that's the worst percent possible that we could kill, because what that means is it kills all of them except the really, really tough ones. And we did an analysis of the space station's microbes recently with some colleagues, and it was interesting in that light.
We're we're talking about some of the teeny tiny organisms that live all around us, on us, and in us with Rob Dunn. He's a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. His latest book is called Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How does all this talk of microorganisms, bugs, and other critters make you feel? Do you have an appreciation for these life forms, or do they creep you out? What questions do you have about what's in your home or other spaces? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're continuing our conversation about all the critters, bugs, and microscopic life forms that we share our living spaces with. Rob Dunn is our guest. He's a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. We're talking about his newest book, Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What kind of interesting critters have you found in your home? What questions do you have about what may be lurking in your basement, bathroom, or other area? Are you excited about all the species living around you or a bit freaked out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
Now, Rob, we were talking about the fact that we often think cleaner is better, but we might be making it easier for the bad bugs to grow. Jeff in Dubuque, Iowa has a question about that, so let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Dunn, the question I have is, which bugs should we be cleaning up for, and what cleaning solutions would you recommend?
And maybe whether we should be cleaning at all, Rob.
That's a good question. So I think one thing to make very clear is that we have a series of sort of public health measures that really help us in controlling the small subset of species that can do us harm. And so if we look at bacteria, there are at least millions of species of bacteria, and some argue there are trillions of species. And about 50 of those are pathogens of humans. And so just a tiny subset. And what we know is that washing your hands with soap and water, cleaning up your dishes with dish detergent, getting your family vaccinated, making sure that our water supplies are safe, that these things are super important in terms of controlling those 50 species and keeping us all healthy. But then what we often do is we go too far. And so I think that the key take home here is to do those things that we know from a public health standpoint work, but not to try to sterilize your home, because all that does is to disfavor all that stuff you need and favor a bunch of weird things. And so keep washing your hands, keep washing your plates. If something starts to smell funky in your fridge or is past its date, get rid of it. But otherwise, exercise a little bit of moderation. Keep your windows open, go outside, bring a potted plant in. All sorts of ordinary things that we used to do and have stopped doing in the last years.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. And Rob, one of the things that sometimes come in and out of our living spaces a lot are pets. What about pets? Are they bringing in some of these organisms too?
They do, and they are, each pet seems to bring in different organisms. And so cats seem to bring in some kinds of fungi that we don't know very much about. They bring in some bacteria. They also bring in a protist that can get into our brains and change our behavior, which is a longer story, but a pretty interesting one.
You wrote about that in the wildlife of our bodies, right?
Yeah, and I elaborate on it more here. But dogs seem to bring in mostly bacteria that seem to be beneficial. So dogs bring in bacteria on their fur, on their feet, and their drool. And dogs have a really big effect on what's in your house. And so if a dog is in a house, that changes dramatically the overall composition of bacteria in that house. And it looks as though, especially in urban environments, that that change seems to be beneficial, especially for children. And it seems to reduce the risk of allergy and asthma. And what we think is happening there is that the dogs are actually our last connection to sort of wild nature. And so if you fail to be exposed to soil bacteria that you need, that those dogs are bringing enough of those microbes in on their feet to maybe get you a little bit of exposure. You know, if the dog is going outside, if the dog is walking somewhere where it's getting those microbes. But we don't know about, you know, in our study, we had some people with indoor goats and pigs, and typically the sample size for those things is much smaller. So we can say the most about dogs and cats.
Or we need more people to keep indoor goats.
Probably there are enough out there, but we haven't encountered them.
So my husband is very diligent about airing out the house every day, opening the windows for, you know, like 15 minutes, getting that circulating, which I always thought made sense in a very general way. But reading your book, it seems really critical that we're kind of constantly refreshing that ecosystem that we're living in.
Yeah, I think opening the windows, you know, assuming that the air where you live is sufficiently unpolluted that you can reasonably open your windows. So in Beijing, it's a different story. But there are actually really nice studies recently showing that if you take a hospital room and you open the windows and you take the same sort of hospital room and you just let the air purifier of the hospital clean what's in that room, that the hospital room with the windows open actually has fewer pathogens than the hospital room with the very best air cleaning system available. And so what we think is happening in those cases is that environmental microbes are blowing in, they're competing with the microbes in the hospital environment. And most of those really nasty things that can be on surfaces, like some of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria, they're not very good competitors except when we use lots of sort of antimicrobials and biocides. And so if you open that window, you sort of tip the competitive balance away from them and in your own favor.
We had a caller who wondered if those ecosystems that live in bathroom or shower drains are affected by microbial soaps and washes when we use them and then they go down those drains.
They do. I mean, we know less about that than we should, but the most common antimicrobial products that we use have triclosan in them. And it's been shown that when that triclosan goes down the drain, that there are actually microbes that can start to break it down. And so drains that of people who use a lot of those products actually have very different microbes. And it's recently even been shown that on the devices that squirt that stuff, so like the pumps with antimicrobial stuff in them, that there are bacteria that live on those pumps and can actually metabolize the antimicrobial compound. So long as they get a little bit of carbon from your skin or something else. And so those they're not only sort of a nightmare in as much as they cause all sorts of problems with fish and other life in water systems, but they're actually favoring some kinds of microbes that are probably worse than the microbes that we hope that they're disfavoring.
Rob, thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure. Rob Dunn is a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University. He's the author of Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets to Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live.